Hi there, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with Linda Vanilla today. Vanilla. Positive Mind, WBAI, 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. Recently last week, we proposed, or I proposed, I said, let's look at personalities as possible alter selves. And I said, you know, as if when you do things that you don't like and when you do things that you find alien to you, it's not you doing it, but it's an alter personality. If you want to hear about that more, you can go to the archives of WBAI or The Positive Mind and listen to that. Well, today I got from MedPage. MedPage today, recent research, they talk about how the brain acts as a drug addiction does when it's especially dealing with food addiction. But here's what we're beginning to learn from neuroimaging that I think is so fascinating and may substantiate my hypothesis. Did I ever think I'd ever substantiate my hypothesis? Well, okay. One of the things we're learning is that if you look at the neuroimaging, you see that completely different parts of the brain light up when you're wrapped up in something that seems neurotic. So if a different part of your brain is functioning, and I mean lighting up, whereas the normal things sometimes go to rest, doesn't that add a little substance to the possibility that you're not yourself? Well, we certainly see it with addictions, and we're learning more and more about that. So let's talk about the alien yous. And today I want to talk about overreacting. I hear so much from people who talk to me about it, their own overreactions and other people's overreactions. And today I want to talk about the major overreaction that's difficult to deal with, which is the narcissistic wound. I promise you, if you understand this, you're going to be able to deal with a big number of people in your life who you have seen become rageful. But in order to understand the narcissistic wound, you first have to understand narcissism. Now, again, if you go to the archives and press in the word narcissism, has a lot of C's and S's in it, you will find thorough shows completed to that, which we're not going to do today. But just for a definition, narcissism is a pattern of traits and behaviors which signify an infatuation and obsession with oneself to the exclusion of all others, and also the ruthless pursuit of gratification and ambition. Narcissists, if you want a couple of pictures of them, you could see the grandiose ones, the ones who get out there. Remember the film Wall Street? In that film, Wall Street has a classic narcissist, you know. Narcissists are always talking about me. I. They use that word a lot, except when they're using an accusatory you. But they're really referring to themselves a lot. If you listen on radio or television to somebody being grandiose, you know, or perfectionistic, it's I this, I that, I this, I that, we, I, you know. Okay, that's narcissism. Now, in the onset of narcissism is in infancy, childhood and early adolescence, and it's commonly attributed to childhood abuse, but we'll get back to that. There's a whole range of narcissistic reactions from the mild to the transient to the permanent disorder. So here, Linda and I went out and did some work on trying to get to the bottom of this, and this is going to be just the definition of narcissism, and then we'll go into the rage.
You know, Armand, according to my research, narcissists are either cerebral, where they derive their narcissistic food from their intelligence or their academic achievements, or they are somatic, deriving their narcissistic food from their physique, their exercise, their physical or sexual prowess and conquests. Narcissists can either be classic, compensatory, or inverted.
Well, there we've got five different things to look at. When you say narcissistic food, what do you mean by that, Linda?
Their supply, the things that need that they need in order for them to manifest this, their narcissism.
And to keep the narcissist going. So now narcissists can be either these grandiose people you see standing up or talking out. It could also be depressed people because, you know, depressed people are very much concerned with the I. They're very much self-centered, even though the self-centered is criticism.
Sure.
Okay, so in an all-pervasive pattern of a need for admiration, adulation, they have a lack of empathy, and it usually begins early. Now, so let's look at the definition of what a narcissist is. Number one, they feel grandiose and self-important. Do you ever see these lot people who always exaggerate everything and they make themselves seem grander?
Sure.
You know? Those kind of people, you know, to the point of lying, demanding to be recognized or superior. You know, this kind of pay attention to me, look at me, I'm this or I'm that. That's one form of it.
They also firmly convinced that they are unique, that they're being special, that they can only be understood and really should only be with an associate or someone else that is manifesting their need for grandiosity.
Well, you see, now that's very interesting because from what you're saying, the narcissistic people, even if they're depressed, they have to have special treatment. And they're also obsessed with fantasies of unlimited success, fame, power, omnipotence, could be. So keep in mind, we have two different types here. We have a depressed narcissist and we have a grandiose narcissist. They require excessive admiration, adulation, attention, and affirmation. And very often, by being sick, you can get that attention. It's the only way. Failing that, they sometimes want to be feared or notorious, which is also happens.
They often feel that they are entitled, that they have unreasonable and special or favorable priority treatment, that that's what they need.
In they're interpersonally exploitive as well. They use others to achieve their ends, and devoid of empathy, they're unwilling to identify with or acknowledge the feelings and needs of others. It's really about them. And when they do, when you see them being empathetic, it's really they're just waiting until they can get the attention back to themselves. So this is a picture of it. Now, this is what's really interesting here, is something brand new called the inverted narcissist. Let me present that to you. The inverted narcissist is a form of codependence. People who depend on other people for their emotional gratification, that's what you call a codependent. Needy, demanding, submissive, they fear abandonment, they cling and display immature behaviors. No matter what abuse is inflicted on them, they remain in a relationship. That's called a codependent. Now, an inverted narcissist, also called a covert narcissist, is codependent who depends exclusively on narcissists. So now what is this? A groupie would be this, right? A groupie. They are dependent exclusively on the narcissist. It feeds them. If you're living with a narcissist, if you have a relationship with one, if you're married to one, and if you're working with a narcissist, it does not mean that you are an inverted narcissist necessarily. To qualify, you have to crave to be in relationship with them, regardless of any abuse inflicted on you or neglect. You actually feel a craving. I have to be with them because they are narcissists. So it's like you're the other side of it. But you don't get the negative attention as they might for standing up. So very often this is the person, the campaign manager for the president. You see what I mean? So in order to be what they call an inverted narcissist, you must actively seek relationships with narcissists and only with narcissists, no matter what your bitter past experience has been. You feel empty and unhappy in relationships with any other kind of person, which explains to you why, when if you're a woman who dates men of power, and then your friends say to you, you should go out with this nice guy. You go out with the nice guy and it just feels empty. Oh, that's the kind of person I should go out with. If you're an inverted narcissist and you go out with somebody who is narcissistic, grandiose, a little wacky, you feel turned on. You feel alive. And you feel dead the other way. So that's another fascinating thing. This is Armand DeMille with you with Linda Vanella. We're looking at narcissistic overreactions. Now, that gives us the background, so you understand what a narcissist is. Narcissistic rage is a reaction to a narcissistic injury. Now, what is a narcissistic injury? A narcissistic injury is when you have an image of yourself that you believe in, and somebody or something does something that cracks that image. It cracks right through the layer. I knew a man who was a good guy. He was really a good guy. He loved being a good guy. Everybody thought of him as a good guy. He was in love with a woman who he had a great relationship with. The two of them were fine. He was such a good guy. She was a wonderful person. She went off on a trip somewhere, on a dancing tour, and while she was away on a trip, she found somebody else and jilted this man. The man fell apart. Now, of course, a lot of people would fall apart when this happens, but falls apart completely. And what happened in this case, as happens in so many relationships where somebody discovers that the other person's been stepping out on them, it's a narcissistic wound, because I, the object of this, believed that everything was perfect. I believed I created a perfect marriage. I believe I gave everything I could into this relationship. I believed it. I believe I'm a good person and I did all good. And here this other person proved to me that my belief was wrong, and that cracked through my core. It shattered me. So when people are shattered by people having extramarital affairs or stuff like that, when you're shattered by it, when it destroys you, that's a narcissistic wound. Because, yes, you should be upset. But upset so that it completely dismantles you? Upset so that it completely takes you apart? No. That's an overreaction, and it's an overreaction based on a narcissistic belief. So that's what narcissism is. It's believed that narcissists have two layers of rage. The first layer of rage can be a thought of a constant anger towards someone else. And this anger always feels like it has a tinge of revenge. One of the cute things about a narcissistic blow is that you just don't get hurt and get angry, but you want to get even, and you're obsessed with getting even. The other layer is when you turn the wrath against yourself. Now, here you become critical of yourself, and that will lead you into a depression. This is Armand DeMille with Linda Vanella. We have done some research on this narcissistic rage to present it to you today. There are different kinds. We talked about a narcissistic injury. The injury is where you get wounded by something that somebody does or something you see that cracks through, and then your rage is your reaction.
Yes, according to the research here, Armand, I've seen that there are two types of narcissistic rage listed, and one is explosive, where there's an obvious anger. For an example, damaging property or people and being verbally abusive. That's one. And the other being the pernicious or passive-aggressive rage. For example, sulking or giving that target the silent treatment. Narcissists can become enraged easily to the point of being homicidal, especially if he or she has a need to seek revenge. Once again, it's that seeking of revenge. that is at the root of that narcissistic rage?
You know, it's funny about the verbally abusive. When somebody threatens to break through to you in a way that you didn't expect that they were going to break through to you, if they crack your shell, you have as much rage as the vulnerability you have inside that shell. Imagine that you're like an egg. You know, and inside the egg, you could either be a fresh egg or you could be a hard-boiled egg. If you get through life, you become like a hard-boiled egg. I wonder if this metaphor is going to work. I've never used it before. And if you get through, you become a hard-boiled egg. And if somebody cracks your shell, you still got some kind of a shell. You know, you're still there. You're still an egg. But if you don't have that, and if you're raw on the inside, if they crack your shell, you spill right out. You're destroyed. The yolk's on you. I couldn't resist it. All right. Perfectionists.
Once again, that metaphor I think is wonderful because you see the need when you're feeling like a yolk, you feel like you're not even solid, that narcissism is considered a form of perfectionism. You see that a lot. An insistence on perfection in other people. And, of course, that goes along with the limitless power of the grandiose or narcissistic self. And so these are rooted in traumatic injuries, again, to the childhood self.
Well, you know, let's talk about the perfectionism first, because, of course, what we're saying about the childhood self is very important. Narcissists are pseudo-perfectionists and require being the center of attention and create situations where they'll receive attention. However, this perfectionism is kind of fascinating. They are picky. If the perceived state of a perfection isn't reached, if I'm a narcissist and I'm looking for perfection and I can't achieve it, I can get guilt, shame, anger, or anxiety because I believe that I'm going to lose whatever it is I'm looking to get, including the imagined love and admiration from the people, because I'm not perfect. Like if it were me, you know, classic narcissist talking to you, and I fumbled over a word or two, I could be very critical on myself. And I may be. That's why I work for WBAI, because they let me get away with with fumbling all over myself. But if you were somebody who had built a big empire, and you were, you know, you're big in the public eye, and you want to be seen as perfect all the time, you tend to be perfectionistic with others. Well, here's its secrecy about perfectionism. The secret about perfectionism is that person who is perfectionistic is always so critical about themselves because they think they may have a fatal flaw. Because as perfectionistic as they are about the outside world, they are perfectionistic about themselves. So now we have a bigger danger. Now that threatens to, the yoke threatens to spill out again. So let's say that a person does something to challenge you in a way that makes you feel like you're not as powerful as you thought you were, or maybe somebody sees through your power. Good example of this. I've seen couples, people who have been in love, and then they get separated or divorced. In the process of separation, usually one or the other, usually the man, is begging, please take me back, take me back, take me back. I admire you, I love you, you're beautiful, you're the only one, da 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 da. But once the person who is the narcissist on the other side turns off, they shut the door. No, you hurt me once. You got through my shell once. You will never get through me again. And they put up a shield. They feel nothing. That's why many of you look and you wonder, how did this ever happen? How did you ever get to that point where you don't care at all for the other person? Because it shields up, you know? Shields up, protect yourself. All right. There was a guy named Edmund Bergler. Of all names. I wonder if he stole this from somebody. Bergler. He said, and his research was fascinating.
Yes, Armand. Edmund Bergler assumed that the preservation of infantile megalomania or infantile omnipotence is of the prime importance. He says that the infant responds with fury to any offense to his omnipotent self, very much that you just described. Thus, for Bergler, the child lives in a sort of megalomania for a long period, confronted with some refusal, regardless of its justifications. The refusal automatically provokes fury, since it offends his very sense of omnipotence.
Now, here we go. This is fascinating. Mm-hmm. Babies who cry and baby who don't cry. Right? I mean, babies, you know, you've been around a lot of babies. Did you ever run into babies, Linda, who are, I mean, could you say that by a certain age, or say, you know, they call by age 6 months. Mm-hmm. Some babies are screaming all the time, and other babies are not.
Exactly. You can see that even before 6 months. You can see that temperamental need, that a baby will be much more likely to cry, and you can watch the caregiver-baby relationship and see how that manifests itself when the baby is in need and desperation, a tense, irritable child. You could see an anxious, and another baby will appear to be much more complacent, much more relaxed. And so you wonder if in that process where the megalomania is.
Well, okay, what is the megalomania? The megalomania is this sense of omnipotence. I am a baby, I am born, the world revolves around me. Well, that's perfectly natural. You come out of the womb, mm-hmm. you have no idea where the end of your skin is or where your hand begins and your mother's hand doesn't. You feel like it's all about you because it is all about you and you're getting all of the attention. So this megalomania, and according to what we found, certain conditions, especially disturbances by the parents, will result in that child becoming more and more like this, omnipotent, and holding on to the omnipotence and not seeing their separation. So now that the child, the infant, feels a crack in their power, and when they feel that crack in their power, they turn it into rage, and what we see as infantile rage, fury, is often the result of a crack in their belief that they're omnipotent. Now, Linda, question for you. When a child is in an infantile fury, would you say there's a 90% chance that it will respond favorably to its mother's breast?
More than 90%. I'd say 95%.
Really?
Sure.
All right, let's look at that. Why? Why? It seems so obvious, oh, because he's being fed, oh, because he's hungry. No. But there is no greater sense of omnipotence than suckling. Everything is perfect. You are the breast. You're back at the breast. You're back where you feel your power.
Being held. And the touch and the warmth and the comfort of body-to-body contact, I believe, is another significant factor.
Oh, so you feel like you're a part of that big body because they don't see a separation yet. So you feel very potent and fed. Little wonder that men are obsessed with breasts. You know, little wonder that they're all trying to get back there in some way. But why wouldn't women be obsessed with breasts since they go through the same thing? Why wouldn't women be obsessed with achieving that themselves, finding a breast to suckle at? So it doesn't hold necessarily true. Okay, so if instead the mother gives her time for the infant to acquire all sorts of dealing with the shock and recognizing of a world that is outside his or her magical control, meaning letting the child have the space to learn that they are not, it's not all about them. Then the child becomes able to be realistic instead of magically annihilating this world. So this is a very difficult thing to do as a parent because the infant, you want the infant to grow on their own, but you also don't want to neglect the infant. You also don't want to just toss them out there in the world. You don't want to take the child and then say, I'm going to put you in the jungle and I'll come back in 6 hours. This way you'll learn, because you want the child to be protected on one hand. So it's a very difficult job parenting, but it goes even further than that because parents generally don't have all their stuff together. And they generally didn't get this perfect parenting as children. All right, so let's go on to this narcissistic rage. Depressions are interrupted by rages because things are not going your way, because responses are not forthcoming in a way we expect. Narcissists, sometimes when they're depressed, now that means things are not going their way, they can't boost themselves up, they search for conflict to find a way to alleviate the pain or suffering of the narcissistic wound. In other words, let's try it this way. I'm trying to get a job. I can't get a job. Nobody will hire me. I'm an actor. I'm trying to say, look, I'm beautiful. I'm talented. You have to hire me. Nobody gets hired. I try out for a really big spot. I don't get it. I get depressed. Now I'm depressed, and I don't know what to do with myself. I'm depressed. Now, on top of that, I was in love with this girl, and she sees me as somebody who's just never going to succeed. She sees my depression. She sees my talking about myself in such a big way. She gets sick of me. She leaves me. Now, how could she leave me? How can I get a job? I sink. I sink into a depression. Now, what's the best thing for me to do? I know what I'll do. I'll listen to WBAI, and I'll get mad about something. I'll find out about the injustices of the world. I'll stand right up and I'll fight. You know, now not all people who listen to WBAI are wounded narcissists who are depressed. But if you want to find the cause, that will help you with your depression. And I am willing to bet that the most malicious people in the world, who are certainly not the WBAI audience, have sitting in somewhere inside them the threat of a depression that could be brought on by their feeling their lack of impotence, their lack of potency. So what they do, and what you have, is you're suffering so much with the pain that you pick up something to fight about, to argue about, to object to. And you'll very often see depressed people in a couple fighting over nothing. What are they fighting about? When the narcissist's sense of self-worth is perceived as being attacked by another person, especially in the form of a criticism, the narcissist's natural reaction is to rage and pull down the self-worth of the other. See, now, you're criticizing me? I'm going to show you how sick you are, how crazy you are, how wrong you are. Remember, revenge. You're threatening to pull me down, I'm going to pull you down. It's an attempt by the narcissist to soothe their internal pain and hostility while at the same time they're building their own self-worth. This is not easy, but it's what happens.
Isn't it similar, Aman, to the kind of a situation where you'll say, gee, that person always seems to have to break me down in order to make themselves feel better.
Sure.
I'm sure it's something that most of us can relate to. Narcissistic rage also occurs when the narcissist is perceptibly being prevented from accomplishing their grandiose fantasies.
In school, applying to schools, mm-hmm. right, and getting turned down, that kind of could lead to that kind of narcissistic rage.
The rages can be seen as a result of the shame at being faced with failure. Yeah. I think a lot of us have oftentimes seen that either in our families and people around us. But, yeah, there's a feeling of when you don't make that job or you don't make that school, that there's a feeling, a deep feeling of shame that you have failed.
You know, once you get triggered into a narcissistic rage, which will be based on fear, you know, the rage is based on fear, it'll endure long after the threat is gone. So once you get into this narcissistic rage, it stays in there for a while. It gets directed toward the person that they feel has slighted them. Then it gets directed to other people. But other people perceiving it say, hey, this is wrong. What are you so bent about? So when you suspect that someone you know is bent out of shape, it's probably for a good reason. Because probably you're right. Hey, this is Armand DeMille with you with the Positive Mind. We're going to take a short break, play you some very beautiful music, and then when we come back, we'll continue and then take your calls. Okay. Ben Webster, tenderly. All right, here we go. How do we go from that to narcissistic injury? So there are three phrases that are used. One is called the narcissistic injury, the next is the narcissistic wound, and the third is the narcissistic scar. The narcissistic injury is an occasional and circumstantial threat, real or imagined, that tends to break through your self-perception, your false self. And when you have this image of yourself and something threatens to break through it, that's an injury. And that we call an injury. Now, the wound is a repeated or recurrent, identical or similar threat. And it finally gets through to you. The wound, regardless of your accomplishments, it just batters you down so far that you give up. Now, the narcissistic scar, which is another interesting phrase, is a repeated or recurrent psychological defense against a narcissistic wound. So you put up a scar so nobody gets it. Hey, you got a scar? No, thanks. I don't smoke. No, you have a scar. Such a narcissistic defense is intended to sustain and preserve the narcissist's grandiose and fantastic self-perception. So when you have a narcissistic scar, you defend yourself against hearing criticism. Now let's go to the presidency of the United States. Right? You want to see a narcissist? Look at the president. Whoever the president is. Right? I don't care who it is. Obama, it could be George Bush. I'm sorry to say them both in the same phrase, but, you know, that's the way you are. That's narcissism right up there. And then you protect yourself from hearing anything that would criticize you. So, you know, what were you thinking? Well, you know, I had people, I'm surrounded by people, like George Bush surrounded him by people, who kind of endorsed everything he was doing. Nobody was saying, hey, what are you doing going to war? They wouldn't dare because they would be fired. So what you do as a narcissistic scar is you immure yourself, you protect yourself by keeping out all forces that would possibly threaten you. Fascinating, isn't it? Now, yesterday we got a telephone call where somebody broke through and we were talking about the real self. And he said, you know, let's go beyond the real self to the existential self. He said, if you take away all the false selves, you wind up with this other self.
Yes, Armand. And in doing my research, it was interesting to come up with the emptiness wound. We sometimes refer to the narcissistic wound, as you just described, as the emptiness wound. This particular wound opens us up to emptiness, to nothingness. It opens us up to the nothingness of the dissolution of the self. No wonder it evokes such terror, which sometimes we feel as actually the fear of death.
You know, it's a kind of a curious thing you say it. Because very often people will talk about the fear of death. And what you're saying is, no, that's just a disguise for it. It's really the fear of losing, breaking through the narcissism and evoking the terror of the dissolution of self. Because, of course, if you're living a plastic self, what would ever make you think that there's anything but this plastic self? So it's certain people who are so dependent on their narcissistic ego, they don't believe there is anything else. Ah, they're thanatophobia. Thanatophobia, which is the word for the fear of death. Fascinating.
Yes, it is the ultimate fear of disintegration and disappearing. The vague sense of dread that we felt before we were directly aware of the wound becomes an immense terror as the wound opens us up to emptiness. It is here that we understand the existential dread and terror unique to narcissism. However, when we understand the situation accurately, appreciating that we are opening up to a deeper experience of ourselves and have the empathic support of the teacher, it becomes easier to surrender to that process.
Surrender to the process of letting yourself lose your mask. And when they say facing this dread and terror, you know, the dread and terror is only an attempt to hold on. You're holding on and you're saying, oh, no, I've got to be what I'm supposed to be because I have no idea what I would be otherwise.
So therefore, the dissolution of the shell is actually a surrender of the self, letting go of our concept of self. The opening can then become an entrance into vastness and into the fundamental presence and really the truth of the self.
Beautiful. Kind of jumps through all things. This is Armand Miller with Linda Vanella. We're talking about narcissism, and we're talking about narcissistic wounds and the overreaction that comes. When you know somebody who's having a major overreaction, when they're furious or very depressed as a result of an encounter, you can look and say, what did they shatter? What image of them has been shattered? Where does this all come from? Let's talk about the childhood origins, possible childhood origins.
The wound to the heart and psyche that gets called narcissism, it occurs when a child's vulnerable and developing core sense of self is not seen and reflected back by the adults around him or her.
You know, each child is born with a unique individual with special gifts and personal challenges, multi-layered, both simple and complex. For any one layer to develop, that part of the child needs to be seen, heard, understood, and valued. Now, here's where we run into a problem. each aspect of the child, these multi-layers, has to be seen, heard, understood, and valued. If you're a highly judgmental parent, if you're an impatient parent, if you don't have time for it, then you don't have time to embrace them.
People have to be present. Parents have to be present to be mirrors, to bear witness and to reflect back. Healthy parents help young people build that frame of reference for living.
And one of the mistakes that parents very often make is they will congratulate each other and say, oh, how wonderful you are, over things that are not so wonderful. So they go in the other direction and they keep building this ego of the child and this child's narcissistic image. You tell a child that they're wonderful, and they look like those people who used to go on television who, you know, were discovered talents, but they had no talent at all. You know, on American Idol, they'd call somebody up there, and this person would sing, and you'd wonder, how do they think they're a great singer? Because they were singing, and they had parents who told them, oh, what you're doing is wonderful, even though it wasn't. A parent could be loving and bring reality to a child, not shatter the child. By the time a parent's criticism of a child gets to the point where the child overreacts, the damage has been done. Because overreactions in an adolescent or in a young adult or even in a child is a sign that the parenting didn't do the job right. Now, I can't blame you for this because, you know, who did the job right with you? Where are you supposed to learn how to do it? So then you wind up with rageful teenagers, outraged teenagers, drug-addicted teenagers, all of it the same thing. All of it just showing you somewhere that there's an image of self that they're trying to hold and that something is cracking that image. Or the narcissistic scar of a teenager, which says, I won't let you get to me. I won't let you shatter my image of myself. I'll be immune to you. Any one adult, a child needs a safe context in which to explore and express their core sense of self. A child needs adults who are themselves grounded in who they are and they have emotional and psychic space to be receptive to the individual child at any moment, rather than relating to the child from their own unmet needs. But, you know, parents also got to work, right? And they don't have time, and they have short tempers, and they're not particularly happy, and their husband's not home. So, you know, nobody expects you to be perfect. All I ask you to do is have this somewhere in your mind, and maybe when you get some time, you address your child in a different way than you may be doing it now. But who blames you, you know?
When a parent's own woundedness and unmet needs override their ability to be present to a child, or a parent's undeveloped parts of self render them unable to respond to a child's vulnerable and authentic needs, the child's very core sense of self can be lost, fragmented, or undeveloped. The loss, fragmentation, and lack of development of the core sense of self is the very root of the narcissistic wound. Raw, broken, undeveloped, and lost, we enter a cold, cruel world, ill-equipped to relate, define fulfillment from the inside out, and connect with the spirit of life.
We cannot live with a sense of depth, because to relate at this level is exhausting unless we are self-secure beings, willing to be vulnerable and chanced being exposed to the core. So when you think about people and how shallow people are, you very often are seeing that they have this threat to their core, see, and they stay in this shallow level because they don't want to go down there. You understand? This is Armando Miller with Linda Vanella, by the way, WBAI. Most people yearn to be known, to be understood, and most of the people that we talk to over the last few weeks and last few programs keep talking about their real self. They're saying, I'm in here somewhere. Would somebody please find me? And then what you have on that is an outer shell, which is defending you from anybody getting through to the real you. Only by living from the core do we eventually get to see what we're meant to be. So this is a, I guess we will have time to take one or two calls today. I wonder if we're going to get to that. Is there a way to heal narcissistic wounds? These problems do not have to plague adult relationships, but they will continue to do so until several conditions are met. So you don't have to, if you think about you and your mate, is that it? Are you doomed to these overreactions? First, the individual must identify that he or she suffers from narcissism and has narcissistic wounds. One day I had a reaction, a personal reaction to something. A friend asked me for a favor. I was doing the favor, and as I was doing the favor, I felt a sense of gloom. I hadn't felt that for years, and I wondered what it was. And I realized I saw a self-betrayal in there that wasn't just now. It went back a long, long time. Now, I'm a lucky guy, because when I see that, I also get excited. I say, ooh, a sense of gloom. I haven't felt a sense of gloom in a long time. And so I welcome it, and I kind of want to go, now I want to go to work on it. Not because I'm such a prince, not because I'm so smart, but just simply because I'd rather live free of that stuff. Because that stuff makes you just act in crazy ways, and you waste a lot of time. So first, the individual's got to be able to identify that you suffer from this and say, yeah, that's me. I want to be special, this. I want to be I want to get recognized. I don't want to be invisible. Yes, I get easily hurt if somebody threatens my image to myself. Once you recognize that, you're halfway there. Second, you have to commit to resolving the carryover from childhood in order to have a healthy adult relationship. Now, I know this sounds like an impossible task. The carryover from childhood is only stuck in crevices. You could have been beaten, you could have been strapped, you could have been tortured as a child. You can recover. The only way we don't recover is when we refuse to let it clear itself out. And here's how it happens. Something happens to you as a child. You believe that this you that's being punished, hurt, abandoned, whatever it is, cannot survive. So you take that you self and you shove it in a closet somewhere, and you create this artificial self, this other self, this narcissistic self. And you come out like Superman. You know, you're Clark Kent, you go in the closet, and you come out and you're, here I am, to save the day. Oh, that's Mighty Mouse. Well, either way, you go in as Clark Kent and you come out as a Mighty Mouse. It's just as good. And then we look at you and we say, oh, what a mighty person, what a good person. And you realize that everybody loves you because you're mighty and good. And why should we even let Clark Kent back in here, you know? Why should we even open that closet door? So the more you leave the closet door closed and the more you're Mighty Mouse running around and everybody loves you for your mightiness, the more it makes it difficult for you to get related to someone. You see, let's say you're a Superman, and now you're just, you know, the hero Superman, and you're the wonderful Superman. Well, you know, you've never seen Superman naked. He can't take that outfit off. It just doesn't come off. So his relationships are very limited, certainly not very physical. So you're limited to you wearing your uniform all the time. You know, you're limited to having to be strong all the time. Very hard to have an adult, mature relationship. Meanwhile, Clark Kent's still in the closet, you know, hiding on the floor because he's scared. So if Superman wanted to have a good relationship, he would go back to the closet and open it up and take Clark Kent out. And he'd exchange with Clark and say to Clark, it's okay, kitty, you could get through. And Clark Kent would live in the world, and Superman would go to sleep in the closet. That was a nice image. Did you see it? I saw it all happening. I saw the picture. Superman going to sleep, you go to the Icy Palace, It's really nice. Clark takes off his glasses, relaxes his tie. He's no longer so shy. He goes find himself another mate other than Lois Lane. It's nice. Okay, thirdly, if you're going to be going dealing with this carryover, you have to actively participate in a kind of emotional healing that will allow this resolution to take place. Now, an emotional healing that would let this take place is very important. And how do you do that? You might have to do it for therapy. It might be requiring professional therapy. But, you know, the trouble with therapy is you have to find a therapist who's familiar with this type of problem. And they forget. They forget what they know. So if you're dealing with this problem and you're dealing with narcissism and narcissistic wounds, it's very specific how you, the therapist, deal with it. You keep reflecting back and back to the person. Yep, here it is. Here's what we see. But if you're just the average therapist, you listen to the person talk about their boyfriends and girlfriends, and you don't really stay on track. You don't have a plan. But those people who can't afford and don't believe in therapy, it may be possible to work through these issues using reading materials, guided learning techniques, similar to those that we use in therapy. Search the internet. There's so much information on the internet that if you put in narcissism and narcissistic wound, you would find 3/4 of my program today. You know, you'd find an awful lot of stuff that you could look at, go over, and challenge. Remember, it took a long time throughout childhood for the emotional difficulties to develop, and it's going to take a long process of emotional work to heal your narcissistic wounds. But okay, you have a lifetime. If you do it by the time you're 80, you're lucky. Then you'll be free then. Maybe you do it by 70, maybe by 60. But it's not just about going to the gym and building your muscles and making yourself strong and staying healthy and keeping yourself immune to everything. You know, you just can't get by just that way. A healthy body is not necessarily a healthy mind. However, it's something that you can do one day at a time. If you focus on a commitment to yourself to create a life in which the relationships that you have with other adults and ultimately the relationships you have with your own children are healthy, mature, and based on a reality, not based on fantasy, not based on hopes, if you promise to yourself that that's what you're going to do and live it just one day at a time, you pick and you do that. Well, it's going to work for you, my friends. Hey, this is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. We're going to have to be going. I will be back with you next Tuesday at 1 p.m. Linda, thank you much, and thank you much for your work today.
Most welcome. Pleasure.
Send me an email, friends. Armand@thepositivemind.com.